I'm going to call the meeting to order, the Ag Policy Committee here. We do have the hour of 12:30, and we do need to keep on time because people are here and they have, you know, time is money. So we're gonna do what we can do. Representative Bly came back today with some test fires back from the. So please have a seat. We're gonna continue with House File 2619, and I know that there are some people that would like to testify in. Yeah. On this bill.
Thank you, Chair. And Tom Peterson is making his way down here. He was the last testifier I had. And then I might have my other testifier come back for questions if people have questions.
Absolutely. And Mr. Peterson, welcome to the committee.
Thanks, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Tom Peterson. I represent the Minnesota Farmers Union. I'll just be really brief. We also support the Forever Green Initiative and have for quite a while and have been working on it. Our main interest in it is cover crops, developing cover crops, a lot of interest in cover crops, and I think it's interesting that we see a lot more interest in cover crops, which is what we want, and people are starting to see the economics of it and also the improved help that it gives the soil, which will help your bottom line in general. And then also forages. Forages are also important. Our forages are changing. We're losing a lot of our forages in Minnesota. And so when we continue to try to add them back or do different things like rotational grazing or alfalfa for grazing, a program like this would be very helpful. So thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Peterson. Are there any questions? Oh, Representative Faust.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I support this bill mostly because a few years ago I attended an organic conference in St. Cloud, and one of the classes I went to, I guess for lack of a better word, that I went to was a farmer from Pennsylvania that presented this hour-long presentation on no-till organic. And what he was doing was working very, very well for him, but he had a little bit longer growing season and more moisture than what we had. And so he had the varieties that he needed to make that work where he was at. And but here we don't. And one of my farmers was going to try to do this, and he even expressed that to me. He says, but we don't have, you know, but if I plant this crop, it doesn't mature in time to do the things that this guy was doing. And so I think that the research that we need to do on this to develop those opportunities is certainly there. And somebody doesn't have to be no-till organic to use that technology and use what hopefully this research will develop to make use of it. And so I think that this is a good idea, and I hope that it works well because it would be nice to have more tools in the toolbox for the farmers in this area. Thank you.
And Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Peterson, I just I share your interest in cover crops. I think you know that. And my question is, and for either of you, efforts to develop those markets, because it has to be a market approach. Are you seeing any progress on that, or maybe another day ideas on how to cultivate those markets so it's to the advantage of the farmer to do it?
And Mr. Peterson.
Madam Chair, Representative Johnson, you know, the market is still corn and beans. You know, the market for a lot of people who are doing cover crops is just improved soil health. They're not always harvesting, you know, the ryegrass or the radishes or whatever they're using. If they can market, you know, harvest the grass or something and use it for something, that's an added thing to their bottom line. But I think what farmers are seeing is soil health and is important, and capturing the nitrogen, and those are things that they can see in their improved yield then in the next year. And so, but also in this report, if you look at some of the Forever Green, some of the work that Mr. Wise and different things in his department, yesterday we had a discussion about Pennycress, which is in Representative Faust's district. We had a thing a couple of years ago, and farmers were really interested in growing that, but we need stronger varieties. We need help in how to harvest it, but the market's there. It's just, you know, continuing to have something like this that would give us more information.
All right. Yes, Representative Bly.
Yes, if I could just have Don Wise respond to that as well. I think he had some comments about building that market.
Sure, Dr. Wise.
Yes, Don Wise, University of Minnesota. Madam Chair, yes, if you look at the document that was in front of you yesterday, I would imagine you have it today. That is really the background piece to, I think, our philosophy around the Forever Green Initiative. I've learned in my 40 years in working with farmers in the state of Minnesota, if you just ask them to do something and it's not profitable, it just isn't going to happen unless there's substantial public support, you know, financial support for it. So what I learned from the farmers in northern Minnesota is if you produce a new crop that is profitable and it can compete in the marketplace, landscape change will occur. So all the examples that we're putting in front of you, at least 80% of those are built around not only developing the germplasm, but building the germplasm of those plant materials that have an economic pull. And by that mean a pull for landscape change. So you know you've heard a few of the examples, all the way from the polycultures, native plants, the work that we're doing with the Aveda Corporation and Estee Lauder and General Mills. It's designed to pull high value components, chemicals out of that material before it's converted, for example, to the renewable energy, which is relatively cheap, right? So what are those compounds? They are preservatives, hair care products, cosmetics, and food are all looking for new preservatives, antimicrobial compounds, high value. Well, the idea would be to develop a new enterprises that would allow for the extraction of those materials that would support the development of those polycultures on the landscape to produce not only biofuels but also other economically viable components for that enterprise.
Yes, Representative Bouguinas.
You mentioned work with General Mills. Could you expand on that about this much?
Yes, Madam Chair. Yes, the work with General Mills looks like this model at this stage. General Mills sent us an agreement, a signed agreement, that as we develop these systems, they will evaluate all of the products that come out of that system for potential incorporation into food products that they currently have and the ones that they would be developing for the future. And a lot of you, I think, realize that General Mills, along with a number of other food companies, now have sustainable programs in those organizations trying to figure out how they can develop a food product or a series of food products that are not only healthy for humans, but are also healthy for the landscape. That is the Forever Green model. That's really what we're trying to accomplish. And we're open to all of those ideas. But we would like to highlight those that definitely have that economic pull. And the same would be true for Estee Lauder and for the Veda Corporation here in Blaine, Minnesota. Same general idea.
All right. I just have a question about University of Minnesota. Part of the, obviously, this is a request to have the Department of Ag give some money to this specific research. But I do have some questions, and maybe Dr. Wise, you and I were talking ahead of time about the changes over the course of 40 years. And maybe we don't need to go back 40 years, but could you just tell me about the funding and how this has worked over a number of years with regards to research at the university?
Yes, Madam Chair, and I think a number of you know my story. I was tricked in coming to Minnesota from Ohio. They brought me in the middle of the summer to work in Rosso and Lake of the Woods counties in northern Minnesota to figure out how to expand the grass seed industry in that area of the state. And I would say that we've been really pretty successful up there. But when I arrived here, we had an experiment station. I think there's been some lack of understanding of what the experiment station is. I work for the experiment station at the University of Minnesota in the College of Agriculture, CFANS, right? When I arrived here, the state of Minnesota actually put $30,000 cash to recruit me here for operating three assistantships, right, to run my program. You might want to guess what it is today. It's zero. So we have to run our research programs, to support those students that you saw here yesterday, whose responsibility is it? We go out and we recruit, write grants to bring in the resources, not only to support the research, not only to support the research, but also those students that you saw here today. They're the next generation of entrepreneurs, the next generation of scientists for this state. So what I'm suggesting to you is, when I had an idea 30 years ago, I would go to the experiment station director and say, hey, we have this idea, this evergreen idea. Would you like to put some money into this? Would you help support it? That's the way the system worked. Today, those resources just aren't there. This is where we show up. LCCMR, all of the other places, as well as at the federal level, to move these types of ideas forward. Right? So here I sit with this list of new ideas. We don't have a commodity group around any of those yet, right? And we know historically, with the reduction in funding from the public sector, the research has been supported by the private sector, including the commodity groups that have been developed off of the resources from the public sector. Corn, soybeans, but you understand what I'm saying. But new ideas struggle. So within the University of Minnesota, you can imagine the battle over resources. And I would just argue, new ideas like this sometimes need some additional public support to get them moving. Right? So that's really what's happened in my career, 40-year career at the University of Minnesota, in the context of funding.
Thank you. I know that last year we had a pretty significant request from the university for their MinDrive project, and the component, four different components of that. And I think, I believe that your department, or this kind of idea that you have, you probably are seeking money through that. Are you doing that as well, trying to seek internal dollars for this?
Madam Chair, sure. We have four proposals in. The team that you saw here yesterday, we're organized. We are putting proposals in. I just learned yesterday that out of that one portion of that pool, there's like 75 proposals from the university for, you know, I don't know exactly how many million, but maybe 3 million, 75 proposals, all of them probably worthwhile, right? But that's the battle that we're in. And some of these ideas that are really new sometimes have difficulty making inroads, but as you well know, we will certainly try.
Well, certainly research is a big part of the university, and I'm hopeful that we continue to support it and not have disinvestment of such research, but hopefully to improve the investment into the future. But it will be interesting to see how that goes. I think students have suffered by paying more in tuition, so hopefully we'll have the opportunity to support the research. Any other questions for the testifier? All right, and Representative Bly, any closing comments?
Just to say that I brought this forward because I think as I heard you say, Chair Poppy, that it's important that we support farmers and the environment, and I think this bill does that.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. So we do have House File 2619 that we recommend that it be referred to the Environment, Natural Resources, and Ag Finance Committee. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay.
Aye.
Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Bly and Dr. Wise. We have House File 2908. Representative Hansen. And we do have an amendment which is in the packet. Everyone should have that. The original bill, 2908, we have the DE5 amendment.
Thank you, yes. Madam Chair, and members of the committee. And I'm going to have Mr. Cruz from the Department of Agriculture here. And I I don't know, has the public been able to get a copy of the DE-5?
It should be the DE-5 that's available. We have it in our packet, I believe, so.
It is here.
Okay.
So maybe folks that are unaware of just how the process works, so there's a...
Okay. So anyone who hasn't seen it, it is down below there. You can get the DE-5. And so Representative Hansen, if you'll speak to the amendment.
Madam Chair, and I would ask the committee to approve the DE-5 amendment, which is a product of work that I've done over the last couple of days to get the bill in the shape that I would like it from. What we're doing in the DE-5 amendment compared to the original bill is at first on Section 1 we're reinstating definitions relating to bees that were eliminated in 2002. When the apiary program was deleted. So in order to have a process here, we're wanting to make sure that we are having definitions that we can have clarity and act upon. So you will see subdivision 2A, 2B, 4C, subdivision 11A, B, bee owner, colony, hive. Those were in Minnesota statute until 2002. And we're putting those in back into 18B when previously they were in 19. So we're trying to consolidate this bill so that it it's within the statutes that apply to the Department of Agriculture. So we have removed in the DE-5 an administrative penalty, rulemaking, those type of things that would have necessitated a stop to the other committee. We did define, add a definition of pollinator. And I know there are some interests that may want to have a broader definition, but we felt for the purpose of this chapter we would define it as insect that pollinates flowers. I know there are other pollinators, but for the purpose of this chapter it's insect. Then we have another definition relating to pollinators on enforcement action. And it talks about willful applications relating to violations of Chapter 18D. Again, 18D being part of existing Department of Agriculture Pesticide Authority. On Section 7, we add in the commissioner's duties relating to pesticide impact on environment. In addition to public health, we explicitly put pollinators and the environment. And then we implement kind of one of the key points of 2908, assembling a pollinator emergency response team of experts to consult in the investigation of pollinator deaths or illnesses. The emergency response team may include representatives from local and state agencies, academia, and professionals. So the idea here on the response team is to provide, to tap the best available science to respond to incidents relating to pollinators. Then we go to compensation, Section 8. Section 8, and the model here that we're using is the model for the wolf depredation and the elk depredation accounts, where in state law we provide, in wolf depredation, there's actually a surcharge on the deer license that goes into the fund to help pay for the loss relating to for the wolf management program if livestock is lost. So. We have a clear, and I think this is important to walk through on page 2, section 8. The Commissioner of Ag would compensate a person for poisoning resulting in the death of bees owned if the person who applied the pesticide cannot be determined. The person who applied the pesticide did so in a manner consistent with the pesticide labels or labeling. And the pesticide, or the person who applied the pesticide, did so in a manner inconsistent with the product's labeling. Okay. And then Mr. Cruz will discuss that in a little bit. We create a fair market value relating to bees. On subdivision 2, we talk about the applicator responsible, claim form, determination. These were all in the original bill. Then we go to denial of compensation. Then in section, and we have an appropriation to pay for claims not to exceed $150,000 per fiscal year appropriated from the pesticide regulatory account. And the idea here, if there is a determination with the best science available for the pollinator emergency response team that it's not a pesticide, if it's a colony collapse that's not related to a pesticide, if it is varroa mite, if it's frost, if it's some other type of loss, that is not eligible for a compensation from the fund. This fund is available when there's a pesticide involved, so it's the pesticide fund paying for the pesticide cost. We've capped it at $150,000 per year. Currently, there is a balance in that fund of about $4 million. In Section 9, we have definitions, restoring, again, most of the definitions, but not the program. I had introduced House File 3077 to have a discussion about reinstating the apiary program. This is an unsession year, so we're not reinstating that program, but I think that's something we're going to need to take a look at relating to bees. But we're reinstating these definitions because these definitions need to be back in statute. And those are relating to apiary, abandoned apiary, Africanized honeybees, bee diseases, bee equipment, beekeeper, beekeeping, colony commissioner, department, and exotic parasite. Section 10, the Department of Ag had presented a report about pollinator banks, and we gave them a statutory direction. I felt it was important to follow up on that pollinator report. And so we've had testimony in another committee about the zoo's work, so we designate the zoo as the official pollinator bank, and that means they do the breeding programs like they're doing with butterflies and moths. There's no appropriation to this, it's just a designation of them being the bank, which was the Department of Ag report gave four definitions, I think, of possible definitions of banks and recommendations. How do we determine the value of bees? Section 11, we have a bee valuation protocol required for determining the fair market value of bees, hives, colonies, apiaries, and queen apiaries for the compensation purpose. And we require that the commissioner report back to these committees on how that process would work. So those recommendations relate back to reimbursement and restitution. And then finally, Section 12, there's a $100,000 general fund appropriation for setting up the pollinator emergency response team. And I would ask for a motion to approve the DE-5.
All right. Well, we will begin the discussion around that. I'm going to have Mr. Cruz, please just go ahead and begin that discussion.
Yes.
From your perspective.
Santo Cruz, the Department of Agriculture. Our support for this bill has been developed over working with Representative Hansen on the language. We do support this amendment. Our hands are on it in the sense that we have worked with him to work around some of the more complicated issues. We feel that this is a very good and workable bill. With regard to the first page, maybe to go back there, not the first page, but be Section 8, lines 2.28 through 2.31. What you have there are the criteria under which you would trigger the compensation account. And number one says the person who applied the pesticide cannot be determined. Number two and three just basically talks on both sides of the issue of saying, well, the person who applied the pesticide did so in a manner consistent with the pesticide labeling or inconsistent. The reason why we've chosen to leave that in currently, though we're open to suggestions on that, is largely because in the Minneapolis situation, the bee kill, which there have been hearings on and has been mentioned and I think is in the popular mindset when we talk about bee collapse, there it wasn't able to be determined whether there was an illegal application of fipronil or a legal cumulative effect application of fipronil. You might say, well, you had that kind of collapse, it must have been an illegal application, but there needs to be some proof there. Here, to get to numbers 2 and 3, you already have to be in a situation where you cannot identify the culprit. So rather than try and prove a negative, it merely is honoring that there, it may have been an illegal application, someone not following it, and that may be determined by the actual study of the bees. There have been times where the department has looked into the levels in the bees in a certain area and said, well, this could not have come from a legal application, either because the product itself is just an illegal pesticide, or the levels found still residual in the bee would be such that you couldn't have applied it under the conditions to in a legal way. However, on the flip side, as in Minneapolis, you may have had 30, 40, 50 people using fipronil to take care of box elder bugs around their house, and we couldn't determine whether or not it was an accumulative effect or whether or not it was one culprit. So it's really just to account for that uncertainty.
And Madam Chair,
Representative Hansen,
I think the response team and the reimbursement go together because we're trying to have the best available science to respond. And the tragic incident that happened in Minneapolis, because of proximity, the U was able to respond. And they were able to find the bees while they were dying, and they were able to make that determination. And I think that actually helps out agriculture. So we're using the science that's available, being fully aware that there is a role between the research institutions and the regulatory. But we want to make sure we're using that science in determining what happens. And they may determine that it wasn't a pesticide. If it wasn't a pesticide, you don't have any remedy with reimbursement from the fund. You've lost it from some other purpose. But having the high-quality team with the emergency response team, that gives an assurance, is our hope, that will have the best available science making that determination. Everything else will flow from that. You know, it's an if-then. If they can't determine it was a pesticide, there's not going to be a reimbursement.
Representative Polk.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess I'd be willing to move the DE-5 amendment.
All right. All in favor of the DE-5 amendment at this point, say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay? Motion prevails. And I think we'll have some additional questions and or additional testimony. Representative Hamilton?
Well, I can wait till after the testimony.
Okay.
Do you have any more?
I would say just generally on the bill as a whole, we think that this bill goes a long way towards setting up a framework to deal with some of the issues that we're already aware of. Obviously, the area of pollinators is one that has been, in this short session, become kind of emerged in multiple hearings and multiple situations. And you've heard me testify already on the truth in labeling bill. We really see this at the department as keeping with addressing what we're aware of now in the best way possible that we can, and not trying to get ahead of the science, not trying, and that's to Representative Hansen's credit. Again, with regard to this bill, it's a pesticide bill in the sense that, you know, if we do have the varroa mite issue, if we have some other chemical or other type of sabotage of a bee, a hive, it's not going to trigger this type of compensation, because this is really about the unintended consequences of a pesticide application.
Representative Hamilton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Cruz, does the department have a rough idea about how many times or that we'll be sending the bee team out? Do we have an idea of how many issues there may be around the state, potentially, claims?
Mr. Cruz.
Madam Chair and Representative Hamilton, you know, I'll have to go back and get real numbers because there are real numbers on it. So rather than kind of estimate, I can tell you that I know just anecdotally that the metropolitan collapse of the three individual beehives on the same day collapsing, that was a case of first impression for the department, but certainly in outstate we've had many cases.
Thank you. Seeing no other questions for you, I'm sorry, Representative Johnson.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. I have a question on line 1.16, and this might be for the author, where it talks about a natural domicile for bees or hive. How do you establish ownership for that? Is it based on where, if it's on my property, is it my hive? Is that how that would work? Or?
Representative Hansen.
Madam Chair and Representative Johnson. First off, this language is exactly what was in statute that was repealed in 2002, so it's taken from the historical language. Secondly, last night I Googled, and you could Google bee law and look at English common law, and it has a fascinating discourse on who owns bees and that ownership versus the wild nature and the difference between domesticated and wild animals and how bees fall into that. So the natural hive that you have ownership of, that you claim on your property, is that you are the owner of that property. The bees may fly out over other property and the colony may leave and it may go to another person's property. You cannot trespass on that property to claim that colony that's moving. But if you have that in a tree hole, for example, a natural cavity on your property, my understanding of common law, and I am not a lawyer, as you know, but this is my understanding, having looked that up last night. Mr. Cruz is a lawyer, and I'm not sure if he's versed in English common law. Maybe Representative Dill is, but that's my understanding.
Madam Mr. Chair Cruz. And Representative Johnson, the issue of possession would be one that would have to be hashed out once a complaint would be made. So, you know, anybody can purport to have ownership of just about anything before there's any type of remedy applied or cause of action or complaint. Once a complaint would be submitted or an investigation would be done, then that determination would be part of the determinative language you see in the bill regarding the commissioner having to put out a report about who's owed for what reason. This is, once again, the determination has to be made in that case for the fund to be accessed that the culprit cannot be identified. The flip side of that is the person who's going to be compensated for the loss must be identified. If there's a dispute about who really owns the bees and we have two beekeepers coming forward and saying, well, those were my bees, those were my bees, that's a separate determination of fact that lives underneath the overall adjudication of the payment.
And Madam Chair and Representative Johnson, so I was giving the broad view and Mr. Cruz on the specificity related to the bill.
And Representative Hansen, I have a question that I'm not sure. I'm just wondering, you have a bee as a means any stage of the common honeybee. There are bees of other sort, and later you talk about Africanized honeybees. Is that something that you came up with? Is that the common, the bee, when it comes to what would be a definition for a bee? I mean, we've heard in maybe not this committee, but in the Finance Committee about the variations of different kinds of bees, and we have how many variations, and I'm just curious about that.
And Madam Chair,
Representative Hansen.
That is the language I took from the historical statute that was repealed in 2002. So the definition of bee and Africanized bee and colony, I took because I figured it would be best to take it from what we have used as a state before. The new language is the pollinator, which would be broader, that would include things like native bees and those type of things where we relate to pollinators. But the language that the definition of bee and bee owner, we're talking about that. I want to be clear on what that would mean. You have commercial hives, but you also have hobby hives where you have the ownership of the hive of the bee as it's defined here.
All right. I do know that there are some people that I'd like to see come down. I don't know if they're willing to or are open to doing that, but Mr. Clavin, we are in the DE-5 amendment, which means that it's been through quite a number of transitional points, and I am hopeful that it's at a point where there's kind of broad agreement for this. And so, Mr. Clavin, I just would you like to testify
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, Bruce Clavin. I represent the Minnesota wheat growers, barley growers, all three sugar companies, the potato growers, and some others. I was elected by my colleagues to come here, so I know that you would wanted to hear from us. We worked with Representative Hansen on this bill since the introduction and really before that with the hearings that were held on the bee issue. That's really gotten to be an issue during this short session. So we've worked with him on the concept. And for the ag policy question of would this be a ag policy, we certainly don't oppose the concept of reimbursing for bee kills. We have that precedent for wolf damage, elk damage in the environmental area. So this precedent has been set. So we certainly don't oppose that. What we've mostly worked on is the mechanics. That's probably why you're at a DE5, and same mm-hmm. with the department. It's just the mechanics of the program. And so we continue to work with him on that, and we have agreed on the concept and the policy here. We have a couple of things that we talked in the hall about, and we don't know what form these will take, but one is the registry. And he mentioned the bill that he introduced on the registry. We think that should still be part of this concept. If you're going to come in for a payment on a claim, the registration of where the hives are is something that maybe should be part of the conversation. We still have a lot of process left. We've got the group across the street to look at in terms of where they're at. And I know he mentioned next year. Maybe it'll be next year. Maybe it'll be this year. But we think that should be part of the conversation if you're going to tap a fund. Secondly is the source. We talked a little bit about the source, whether it should be general fund, pesticide regulatory. The DE on 4.6 to 4.8 has the pesticide regulatory account. We talked a little bit about that this morning again in the concept of the wolf kills on cattle. And I was reminded that some of the deer license goes towards that, so there is some precedent for tapping a special fund for that. But that's a discussion for the next committee stop, but I wanted to point that out to members. We talked a little bit about spiking. What happens when you have bee collapse or you have some other death and there's a spike or a willful spraying of the colonies after the death so that it can be proven that it was, in fact, a chemical. We address that in here with the willfulness. I forget. I think it's 2.5. So that concept or that concern has kind of been looked at. And lastly, I'm glad this is finally coming up, and that's this legal conversation. It was just touched on finally, common law duty. We've heard a lot from a lot of people on this issue, but we haven't really talked about one of the land use conflicts, and that is what duty do people who own 80s and quarters have to producing honey? When you look at a hive that's across the road from you out in whatever county you're in, and the bees mill about to go pick up the pollen, you know, in a sense, they're not trespassing necessarily, but when they come onto your farm and pick up some pollen on your field where you've sprayed a legally approved product in a legal manner, and they pick it up and return to the hive and infect the hive, at what point does the person with the 80 growing the soybeans or whatever have to the production of the honey? We haven't talked about that. We've talked about the use. We talked about the special review. That was, I think, this fall. Or maybe January, I forget. But that concept is a little cloudy as to where my duty begins and ends as I'm producing my crops or my members' crops. And so that conversation is relevant here, I think, because we don't want to have suspects made out of folks that are doing things according to Hoyle and doing it according to the book. That's addressed in the DE5. If you can't determine who went off-label or who sprayed when the wind was too high, that would be a violation of the label. But because the bees travel so far, you may have toxins being picked up at any location. One of the four farmers surrounding the grove may have gone off label, but we're not going to be able to determine that. And so we want to make sure that the legitimate users aren't going to be suspects and that we have to defend ourselves saying, no, we actually did it right. And so I think that's addressed in the DE5. But that's an issue that has not been talked about in this conversation yet.
Thank you, Representative Hansen.
And Madam Chair, and I think I mentioned maybe yesterday or before, there's House File 3077 that I dropped in, but I dropped that in to start that conversation on that it reinstates the apiary program. And I said, I think yesterday, I have no intention of using bills as vehicles, and I want to keep my word when we're dealing with these things. So, and I expressed that to some of the interest. But I believe what we have here with the DE5 addresses the concerns, still provides the response the reimbursement and the restitution that's there and the protection if there was malice involved. So I think that adds something. If we've got somebody who's going to be finding a beehive and wanting to do harm to it, and sometimes there are people who may want to do that, that provides some protection for the people who own the bees. So I appreciate working with the group, and I would ask, and I'm happy to answer questions and have any other testimony, but we've made a long step here, and it's an important issue. We're not dealing with any bans. We're not dealing with any regulation. We're dealing with what happens if we've got a loss of bees, and we're using models that are existing in law, and I'm hopeful that we could pass this out of here and then move it to the Finance Committee, and we can have the discussion about the source of funds.
I just have a question for Mr. Klavan. So would you say at this point in time the DE5 is an acceptable version for you and the people that you're purporting to represent here today?
Madam Chair, I think the DE5 is. I wanted to let the members know, again, I don't know what will happen across the street. The registry conversation may be part of that discussion. We don't know, but I want to let the members know. I know Representative Hansen's made commitments, and so we wouldn't expect him to do otherwise. And then the funding discussion is next stop. So,
thank you. Any questions for the testifier?
Thank you, Madam Chair, members.
Any other people that would like to testify on this bill? We have somebody coming down. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Bill Bond. I'm Executive Director of the Minnesota Crop Production Retailers Trade Association and the Minnesota Certified Crop Advisors. And I want to thank Representative Hansen for working with us. And we are not at all standing here in opposition to what Mr. Klavan has indicated. I wanted to offer a little clarification on the registry question, because as some of you will remember, the essentially at the request and concern of the beekeepers, that registry process at the department was eliminated. It's an issue that then creates a question for applicators: where are the hives located? Because of that, Purdue University created a program called Drift Watch, which some of you may be familiar with. But in talking with the department, as we consider establishing a registry again as part of this process, it probably makes sense, rather than going back through that administrative process in the department, to work with this Drift Watch. And I think you'll hear that from the department as well, in that it is a geospatial recognition by state, by county, by section of where items are, be they fruit or be they wine, grapes, vineyards, and then you could also identify honey colonies. So that is something the department is currently working with. Our association is a member of that group, and an industry is supporting that as a remedy to those issues about where are sensitive plants, grapes, or honeybees located as we're doing our application of pesticides. So I wanted to just speak to that. And we have a sensitivity, as I've told Representative Hansen, about the pesticide fund. There's a sense it's a user fee. We have a sense of owning it. The amount that's being identified here and the way that it's administered seems to be a low risk of dipping into that fund substantially. It does have a significant amount of money in it, and it is paid by applicators and those that provide pesticides. With that, thank you for
thank
working
you.
With Representative Hansen, and
thank
I stand
you.
For any questions.
Thank you. Are there any questions for the testifier? Representative Hamilton.
Just thank you, Madam Chair. Just a clarification. Are you okay with where the source of money is coming from? I'm sorry, I had a little conversation going on here, but coming out of that that fund, or should it be coming out of the general fund? Or
Madam Chair, Representative Hamilton, we really like the idea of the expertise coming from the general fund. That makes sense to us, and there may be some expense as these incidents come up. Coming out of the pesticide fund, there is precedent we wouldn't object to it. It's something we pay attention to, but it's reasonable given the components of the bill.
All right, thank you. Anyone else? Ms. Roop, and you'd like to come forward, testify? Please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Christy Allen. I saw all of you yesterday. Thanks for having me back. After I left yesterday, I called my uncle, who's a commercial beekeeper, and asked him if he wanted to say anything about this bill. And I'd like to read to you what he said. It's Ed and Eileen Menifee. They're from Barbell Bee Ranch in Squaw Lake, Minnesota. And they're out in California right now. They're breeding bees for this coming season, so they can't be here. They're also among two other testimonies I'd like to read from Dan Whitney of Otter Tail County. He's a commercial beekeeper as well, and Steve Ellis of Barrett, Minnesota. So they're friends and family and colleagues of mine, and this is a really important bill for all of us as beekeepers. So this is what my uncle and aunt said. When Christy asked me to write a statement she could read at the legislature, I stayed awake last night. I felt my role had changed. You see, my bees are dying. When you provide a service in an industry like pollination, it's never easy to see the outcome of your workers' persistence to do a good job. You place your trust in your fellow man, not realizing how little control you have. Your bees fly into a haze of chemical application in their quest for food and nectar and bring back a lethal cocktail to their sisters and brothers. The effects were apparent in the piles of bees in front of the hive, and in case you see the girls reaching out for sustenance from the hatching brood patterns, only to slowly run out of energy and die. Awake now at 2:30 in the morning, I am mourning the loss of my girls. So I'm suspicious that a farmer applied a chemical on his crops, not knowing it would have an effect on the bees. He was only trying to secure his future. What is my future when this happens? I can't replace the workforce that dies, and there's no compensation available when the bees die. It's not only the loss of bees, it is the loss of honey production or pollination income. We are seeing more and more bee losses every year with less production and shortened lifespans. A major chemical application can and has put beekeepers out of business. Thank you for listening, Ed and Eileen Menifee. The next one is from Dan. He's the president of the Minnesota Honey Producers Association. He says that the association appreciates the intent of the bill to compensate beekeepers for losses of colonies due to acute poisonings. It is great news to our organization that the Minnesota legislature recognizes the importance of honeybees and pollinators. Two of the association mission statements are to promote the health and welfare of honeybees and to educate the public about honeybees. Exposure of bees to sublethal levels of pesticides are equally detrimental to colony survival and account for more dead colonies at the end of the season. Who should pay for that? When you look at the big picture of things, most beekeepers would trade a few hundred dollars of compensation for safer honeybee habitat and healthier lives. And then the last person is Steve Ellison from Old Mill Honey Company in Barrett, Minnesota. He said that people who are making and selling these products should be liable. This bill is one step towards bringing people to take responsibility for the damage they cause. Bees are warning us of bigger things to come. And I just want to say from my own personal testimony that when Aaron and I started beekeeping at my uncle's commercial operation in northern Minnesota, and Mayor and I joined forces to start our business, The Bee's Knees. We thought, well, what happens to our business plan if bees go away? You know, it was a flaw. It financially doesn't make sense. And we would always just have a nervous laughter, and we knew that if bees would go away, we'd have much bigger problems to think about. So problems are here, and they're knocking down the door, and along with my business, my family, friends, and colleagues, they're suffering. Unlike other farmers, beekeepers are not compensated or supported for their losses. You're looking at the next generation of beekeepers. We're it. We're here to ask your help, protect our future as farmers, and we urge you to make the right choice in supporting us. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions for Ms. Allen? Thank you. Anyone else who would like to testify? Any other questions from the committee members? Oh, we have somebody else who would like to testify. Please come forward and state your name for the record.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, committee members. My name is Lex Horan, and I'm an organizer with Pesticide Action Network. I'll be brief. I'm here to voice the support of our 2,760 members in our state of Minnesota for this bill. As one of the top five honey-producing states in the nation, we see this as common-sense legislation that will help make it possible for beekeepers to continue their important work. We have long-standing relationships with beekeepers. Over the past 5 years, as colony collapse has become a more commonly understood problem, we've been working with beekeepers across the state and across the country on these issues. And as some of the beekeepers we work with often say, there's no other industry where it would be considered normal or sustainable to lose 40% of a business year after year. For the critical pollination and honey production services of honeybees to continue, beekeepers need policy that supports them to rebuild their businesses after pesticide kills take place. This legislation is a straightforward policy solution to the most visible piece of the puzzle that is colony collapse. That's especially relevant because acute kills are not the only manifestation of pesticides' effects on honeybees. More and more research is demonstrating that when bees are exposed to sublethal levels of pesticides, immune systems, navigation and foraging ability, and mobility are seriously impacted. An acute kill on top of those long-term losses is a financial burden that beekeepers are struggling to bear, and state policy could step in to mitigate the problem. This legislation builds important infrastructure in the state to respond to bee kills, and it will help all of us who are concerned about honeybees and beekeeper livelihood better understand the nature of the problem. Thank you.
Any questions for the testifier? All right, thank you
very much.
Thank you. Yes, Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I just have a question for counsel in the title of the bill. If it is necessary to remove the providing civil liability, just to make sure we're not having to make another committee stop if the title needs to be changed.
Mr. Sullivan.
Madam Chair and Representative Hansen, the D5 amendment, the final line 5.25, directs the reviser of statutes to amend the title accordingly. So when the reviser's office processes the committee report and creates a new engrossment of the bill, they will change the title and remove references to civil liability since that section has been removed.
Thank you. All right. Seeing no further questions, no further testimony, Representative Falk renews his motion to move House File 2908, amended with the DE5, and refer that to the Environment, Natural Resources, and Ag Finance Committee. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay. Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Hansen. I just want to say thank you also to Mr. Sullivan and to the testifiers today and to the people within agriculture who worked on this with Representative Hansen. Thank you. We do have one further agenda item, and that is Representative Fritz has been, this is her third time up to bat, and we're finally giving her the chance to swing. So, Representative Fritz, thank you for being at the ready for the last three times. But she has a legislative district report, and she's going to get some assistance here. In the meantime, could we have somebody move the minutes? Representative Hamilton. So moved, and those are the minutes from March 12th as well as March 13th. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay. Motion prevails on the minutes. Thank you.
Madam Chair, and thank you, members. I have third time to chat. And I hope you all enjoyed the cheese that I brought up last week. That is an award-winning cheese from my district, from the Cheesecake.
They run out of crackers.
Run out of crackers?
I've still got cheese. I don't have enough.
I'm sorry about that. It was delicious and fresh and wonderful, and I'm very proud of that. I won't take up much of your time. I'm actually passing out what we've all had and been able to look up about our districts and some information. I've lived in Rice County all of my life. I actually was born in Northfield, Minnesota, and outside of our little 10-acre hobby farm where I have raised ponies with my dad. I'm the oldest, so I was my dad's boy. I hayed, I put up hay, I drove the tractor, took the manure spreader out, dumped it, and had a good old time enjoying the summertime on a small farm. My dad was a plumber, but he was fortunate enough to bring us on a checking machine. It's all different now, but that was nice. I never did milk cows by hand because I didn't have to. But he really got into it. It was a great hobby for him. It lasted, I think we were there for about 25, 30 years. And then my parents decided to retire and move to Florida, so they sold the farm. We had a great time growing up on the farm. But outside of our, across the way, actually over on Highway 3, was a sign that I saw every day of my life, and it was Northfield, the town of cows, colleges, and contentment. And my upbringing was contented. So I know that's how I feel about farming. I go way back. It's a contented, really good way to raise children and to grow up. So I was fortunate to have that, and I just wanted to share that with you. But let me get back to Rice County. I moved to Faribault, Minnesota, where I married my husband, and he's been there 5 generations of Fritzes. But it's part of Rice County. And Rice County, the Faribault area that I represent, is a very diverse ag economy. If you look at the sheet that I gave you, I believe that we're 36 in livestock production, but the pie chart will show you it is diverse. I have poultry, I have dairy, I have cattle, I have hogs, a lot of turkey. And in Faribault, the town that I live in, actually, I have, I'll just name a few of the ag-related businesses. And one of them is the Hormel Genuine Turkey Processing Plant. It's been there many, many years. And they process every kind of bird, from the whole bird right on down to, I think you can get taco turkey meat now. It's really advanced. So it's very good, and it's good for us. Also, I have Faribault Foods, which was the old canning factory years ago. They'd haul corn in, in those days, I think it was butter kernel, and butter kernel is still there. That goes back to 1985. That's a very up and running, very economically, agriculturally economic business. And actually, they're well known nationally. They did win, I think, 3 years in a row, the Silver Plate Award, which is a can for a can. You buy a can of butter kernel corn, and they donate a can to hunger. So I'm proud of that company and that service that they give back. Know many of them. I know the Kinsetts. I know the Kinsetts that run it now. I knew their dad. And so it's interesting that you can live in a place as long as you have. And I know like 5 generations. And it's great to know that these kids are growing up and now running these companies. Also, I have the Faribault Woolen Mills, which you may have heard about a while back. That had been closed, but it actually started 147 years ago. And they have some new people from out of town bought that, and they started it up again. And those are they used to do the blankets that you got in the airplanes, and I don't think they have that any longer. But I know that they do have very good woolen products, blankets, and all kinds of garments. So that is a long-standing company in my town. And also, I'll end with the Cheese Caves. The Cheese Caves I think started in 1930s. It was the original cave carved, and it's still there. You can actually tour it. My husband tells when he was a little boy, he would go in there with his dad. His dad was a trucker and hauled the cheese. And they would go in, and Jim could take, carve off a great big hunk of cheese and eat it. So it was a treat. But it is still there. They also have a restaurant, a very nice delicatessen restaurant, which is only a couple of years old, which is located right downtown Faribault, where I bought the cheese that I brought up last week. So I think we do have, and I'd like to go to a video, if I could, about the Cheese Cave in Faribault, and I'll end there. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
It's the Cheese Cave. And they'd serve wine at the Cheese Cave, too. It's a lovely place. Come down.
Ooh. We should take a field trip, Madam Chair.
Oh, we got to push that. Oops.
Yeah, you should.
An issue with playback. I don't know.
During our flood, we had to haul cheese out of there. The sandbag.
The computer itself is muted.
Oh, okay. No, it's not.
Nope, sir.
You're going in it?
start over.
That's great. Play by play.
Is there a switch between the computer and the microphone?
Yeah, everything's hooked up.
So, we manufacture messages.
While we're waiting for that, I'll tell you that obviously I can drive through Faribault on my way home, and I stopped last week when I, after we had the cheese here, I bought some of that blue cheese. Wasn't that the best? Wow, that was good. I had to have some at home, so just that. That was good stuff. And
I never liked it when I was little. I actually didn't like it until I was married and had it on salad. And it's an old salad my mother used to make. You cut up Granny Smith apples, mm-hmm. and then you have your lettuce and walnuts, and then you can sprinkle blue cheese on that, and then a dressing over that. And it's kind of like an old Waldorf walnut. So they serve that at the cheesecake.
Huh? Say, Madam Chair,
that we're developing, we're going to become one-dimensional. Blue is a fairly fast make.
You got that figured out, so now we can start at the beginning. Here we go. Thank you.
The story of the caves begins about 10,000 years ago. The river valley carved out and exposed a special type of sandstone called St. Peter sandstone. The cave lends two things that can't be duplicated in a manufactured environment. One is incredible stability. Cheese is like people. They want steady conditions. And St. Peter sandstone's a remarkable natural resource. It's 99.9% relative humidity and 52.5 degrees Fahrenheit year-round. The second thing that caves do, and this is truly magical, is they have memory. So for instance, our caves actually have memory of brewer's yeast. We can show evidence of it on some of the cave walls. At Faribault Dairy, we are curious cheesemakers. We've made about 5 or 6 different styles of cheeses here, all in a quest to learn more about making cheese. I was worried that our young cheesemakers that we were developing were going to become one-dimensional. Blue is a fairly fast make, and it's a fairly straightforward make. Learning the complexities of cheddar teaches you a lot about the difference between wet acid and dry acid in a vat. Although a mold or a yeast appears on the surface of a cheese, it's actually able to affect that entire cheese. So when you see that surface mold and yeast, it's migrating those same flavor compounds and metabolites back into the interior of this cheese. In supporting our small town of Faribault, we opened a retail store on Central Avenue, which is our main street. And it was our way of boosting the local economy, trying to get some people into the downtown. Was a roaring success at the Cheese Cave.
Stand here as long as you want to try as many different cheeses as you like. There we go.
I got into this business because I was attracted by the science. And one of the things I brought to people early in my cheesemaking career was more of a scientific approach to cheesemaking. What's kept me in cheesemaking, though, is the art. I'm amazed at the complexity and yet the simplicity of a great piece of natural cheese.
Thank you for sharing that. Are there any questions? Yes.
To be able to tour something like that, if you go to that restaurant or go to that store and they
No, they don't. They no longer give tours in the caves.
Oh, they don't.
And I wish they'd change that. I think we should talk with them on the tourism people. Yes. People down there. They should reinstate that again.
Yeah. Well. Yeah. So yes. This has been. I really enjoy all this, and yes. I was sharing this with my wife, and I said, we're hearing about all these really cool things across the state, so we're taking notes for a little family trip around to see some of these things. So, yeah.
I agree. Thank you. Next week, this was our policy deadline this week, obviously. Everybody knows that because you're in other committees as well. But we do have a couple of bills next week that we're going to have informational hearings on. Representative Anderson will have one that we'll hear, and Representative Clark. We're going to learn a little bit about urban agriculture next week. She would like us to spend some time on that, and she has a couple of bills as well. And Representative Johnson has a bill that we actually may vote on, and I'm not sure if the Senate heard any other bills that we didn't hear. Those are would come to us as well. So, but we appreciate that the people have been here, and thank you for, yes, Representative Hamilton.
So if there's time, you know, I've done some work. I think I shared that with you with Humboldt High School in Highland Park,
yes,
in St. Paul. And there's some remarkable students who are in FFA, and they put together a nice presentation and stuff right down here in St. Paul about agriculture. And so when I went and spoke to them, they said they'd be more than happy to share it with, you know, committee or anything like that. So if there's time, we can reach out to Mr. Brown, who's the teacher. So I can't remember if I brought that up.
I think we'll be looking at, because we've got, we do have Wednesday and Thursday, and like I say, I'm not sure if we have anything else, but we maybe would have Representative Anderson's bill on Thursday, and then could have that possibility. So, but thanks for the suggestion. And FFA Day is Thursday, so that would be a good opportunity to do that. So, thank you. Seeing nothing else, meeting adjourned.